Accession number 10231, reel number 3.
Earlier that the amount of freedom you were given as commandos to do your own thing.
Well, I think this was a feature of our war, really. No doubt, largely due to Churchill's leadership. He liked original characters. He liked eccentrics. And in that long period between Dunkirk and getting back onto the continent, it was, I think, immensely good for the army that a lot of scope was given to individual officers to work out their own ideas in training and ways in which things could be done. But, of course, the whole commando world attracted some very strange characters to it. Some were extremely competent, useful people who were very successful later in war, and some were just total eccentrics. Lock Islet, the training centre, became a sort of home of eccentrics. We had somebody up there called Commander Murray Levick who tried to make us live on pemmican. We all pretended we lived on it, but we used to go off and get a good meal off venison or something down in the village after supper. My first commanding officer was a total eccentric. I'd just been told to join Number 9 Independent Company in April 1940, and I called at my home, stayed a night at home. My father drove me on there and dropped me, and as we approached the place at Ross where we were collecting, we saw a figure with a cap pulled over one eye, a service cap pulled over one eye, Royal Welsh fusilier flash, breeches without any stockings and gym shoes, swinging a shillelagh with his service dress open. He was a major, and he had certainly a DCM and bar, and I think MM. My father, after a few minutes, recognized him as somebody who had been his galloper in the Curragh in 1912. He'd been a trooper, and then he got a commission, and he'd been a black and tan. And he was a terrifying figure. Totally eccentric, usually drunk. Anyhow, after about lunchtime, quite an original person. We had some wonderful schemes with him when we were training before we set off for Norway. And he used to lecture us on how to kill people. He had one lecture about killing people with a fork, a table fork and other instruments in trenches and that sort of thing. And I was talking to my soldiers afterwards about it, and a nice young farm labourer called Jenkins asked me what I thought of it. He said, I don't think he's right to use Mr. Swain. And I said, no, I couldn't see myself doing it, could he? And, no, he said, I think it's very unchristian. And Major Siddons wasn't a very Christian person. But he was the origin of Evelyn Waugh's characters, Brigadier Richie Hook. Anyhow, in this respect, that he did jump up and down in the rifle butts, inviting us to shoot him when we were practicing, which was his way of hardening us up. Apparently, after he'd heard this soldier of mine saying that he thought killing people with a table fork was unchristian. But we had a lot of characters like that. I mean, you mentioned Mike Calvert was another character. And we did rather collect them. Some of them were quite hopeless because they were too eccentric, but some of them added a lot of imagination to training and I think helped to develop the eventual character of the commandos, who weren't really completely trained until 1944, 1943-44. They were very amateurish to begin with, although some of them were regular officers. I think by the time they got to D-Day, that first commando brigade was a very professional brigade under Lord Lovett and Brigadier Mills Roberts later.
I don't suppose you ever came across Evelyn Waugh, did you?
No, I didn't. I might have done on any number of occasions. He was up at Lock Islet, our training centre, and I had a lot of mutual friends, people who served with him. I never met him. I'd like to, because I'm an immense admirer of his novels. I think he's a wonderful novelist. But he was a rather, you know, there was one commando. It was formed in Whites. in the bay window. That was the one formed by Bob Laycock. I think to begin with, he tended to get a lot of ex-household cavalry officers who had left the household cavalry to go to their estates and had come back again, too old, really, for the commandos, and too eccentric and not very fit. I don't think they lasted very long. But, of course, Laycock himself was a fine soldier and one of the very formative influences in the development of the commandos. He succeeded Lord Louis as commander of combined operations.
It seems extraordinary to think of somebody like Evelyn Waugh in a commando unit.
He was very brave. Evelyn Waugh had no fear at all, as I'm told in Crete. He was a very brave man, but he was terribly unfit. And his great, I mean, his awful fault as an officer was that he was contemptuous to his soldiers. One thing he was never be as an officer. And he was so disliked by the soldiers that Lord Lovat, it comes out, I think, in Lord Lovat's own book, March Past, he was frightened that one of the soldiers would put a bullet in his bag. And of course, he was one of the greatest novelists of his time. He was a wonderful novelist. He never ought to have been in the army. It was ridiculous.
You were mentioning to me earlier, I wonder if you can repeat it, about an exercise you had with Alexander present.
Well, it's always seemed to me that we were very lucky in our war, that a lot of scope was given to people with a bit of imagination to work on their own training and try and work out what was suitable for what we had to do. Of course, the climbing and mountaineering was one side of it. The boat work was another. My little contribution was reading an article in the Illustrated London News on street fighting by the Germans, how it was part of their training. And we found a ruined village near between Kilmarnock and Irvine in Ayrshire. And we started imitating the Germans' technique of blowing holes in the walls and going from room to room, throwing percussion grenades through before going into a room, and also going along the roofs and blowing holes in the roof and going down from the roof. And we put on quite a show of this, and General Alexander came round, and we did our turn for him. Unfortunately, one of the soldiers threw a grenade in the wrong direction, and it hit a lot of slates and blew a lot of slate around, and people got splinters in them, and there was quite a lot of blood. General Alexander, when I reported to him, asked if any casualties, and I said they were only superficial. No eyes damaged, he said. And I said, no. Ah, he said, I like blood on an exercise. It's very good. As long as nobody's hurt. It was great fun. But, I mean, that was, you know, we had the freedom to do this. Colonel Newman, who commanded at Saint-Nazaire, he and his second command, Bill Copeman, were a wonderful training team, and they gave their officers and soldiers immense scope to work things out. One of the things, you ought to ask Michael Byrne about this, but at one stage they were sent off to see how easy it was for a spy to get information and make inquiries and spread alarm and despondency. I don't remember the story exactly, but they had great fun doing this. And they got all over England and Wales spying out things. Some of them got arrested and in trouble with the police, but Michael Byrne could tell you about that. A number two command, they did a lot of this, rather imaginative training. One of the reasons that they were selected for the Saint-Nazaire raid was that they probably were the most imaginatively trained and best led of all the commandos. Colonel Newman was a very keen territorial who was a contractor by trade, very gifted man. He was a racing motorist. He was very, very high-grade amateur boxer, middleweight, good rugby player. Racing motorist, wrote a lot of the tunes in those pre-war shows, Sweet and Low, Sweeter and Low, and Sweetest and Lowest. He was a lovely man. He was a wonderful commanding officer and leader, but very unconventional and had immense confidence in people and willing to give them a lot of scope, let them get on with it. They were a very well-trained command there. They were very good material, as I said earlier. They were well-educated people.
You mentioned that minor accident, but were there any more serious accidents that you witnessed?
Oh, yes. I fell down Ben Nevis I was at Loch Islet on a demolition course, I think it was. No, it was a field craft course, I think. We had a weekend off, and Jim Gavin, who was later General Gavin, who was in the Everest 34 expedition with Smythe, asked myself and another officer if we'd like to climb Ben Nevis with him. And we went up the north face. We went up number 3 gully. And the weather closed down when we got to the top, and he decided to go down Moonlight Gully, I think it was. And it looked like snow. It was actually ice, and we only had one ice axe. And we were roped. And the other officer, Owen Hare, was a very clumsy person. And he kept on getting tied up in the rope a bit. And eventually we unroped, because Jim Gavin said he couldn't hold two big men on one ice axe. Three big men on one ice axe. And we unroped, and Owen Hare trod on a step and went slithering down, and I did the same. And when we got to the bottom, he had blood coming out of his ears, and we had to get a rescue party. And early in the morning, we came to the conclusion he was dead. And he was one casualty, which I was actually a witness. We lost a sergeant major. We had a very good sergeant major called Sergeant Major Coleman, who was killed climbing. We used ball ammunition. People, I know, were occasionally hit in our exercises. But this happens, of course, with the Army today, with the commando training. People are lost. And you can't really do proper, realistic training unless you take risks like that.
What had made you go in for this kind of Army work in the first place?
Well, I think the same thing as everybody else. I was given the chance by being asked by my colonel if I'd like to join the independent company. I preferred that sort of freer world to the more regimented world of an ordinary battalion. I think it was what made people join us later. You had more scope to do what you wanted. You didn't live in barracks, too, which was lovely, and lived in private houses And also, of course, we were all well paid, because officer got 13 and 4 a day subsistence. That was tax-free. And 13 and 4 during the war was quite a bit.
Soldiers that I've interviewed who are in the commandos have claimed to me that they were terrified of being returned to unit.
Oh, yes. It was a great disgrace. It was a wonderful sanction against both officers and soldiers. Being returned to your unit meant that you'd failed. People dreaded it. And it was far, far greater punishment than being sent to the glass house, because you went back with your tail between your legs. And, of course, we had much more fun. We climbed and we stalked and we got all over the highlands and went out boating and fishing. It was wonderful.
They also told me another thing, which you might like to comment on, which was that they were very disappointed if they didn't actually go on raids.
Yes, because you see, it was rather like an athlete training for a race. You know how this business, you get to your peak if you're an athlete. You get very fit and you come to your peak and it's just the time to run your race, and then it's cancelled and you go back again, you start again. We used to train for these raids and have the orders and everything get taken away and put somewhere, and then they'd be cancelled. And it was a great disappointment. I mean, we were in it to fight, and I don't think any of us really wanted to kill Germans particularly, but one wanted to do what one was trained for. And I was on one or two cancelled raids. Some people were on half a dozen. Because during that period between 1940, when we were building up equipment and training, although there were some very good ideas, hardly any of the raids came to the boil, except the Vagsa raid, which of course was a great success, and the Lofoten raid. And they were carried out. There were small raids on the coast, small individual landings and so on. But the Saint Nazaire raid, after the Vauxhall and Lofoten or Lofoten raids, I think was the first, really. It was the first big raid. And then Dieppe. They're very difficult to mount raids. Getting the Navy to put you in the right place was a difficulty. Navigation in close waters is always difficult, and navigation in small craft is difficult. And a lot of the navigators, the naval officers, weren't highly skilled pilots. They were amateurs, very often yachtsmen. And we used to curse them like anything, but I think they probably did quite well.
Looking back on the Saint Nazaire raid now, what are your own reflections on the raid from this point in time, so many years
ago? As to its achieving anything, I think that we did achieve a lot. I think the blowing up of the dry dock, it's very easy to say now that the Tirpitz never came out. But, I mean, that was the objective. It's now said by some people that Hitler never intended to bring the Tirpitz out. But did he never intend to bring her out before we destroyed the only dry dock that would take her? It may have been a consequence of our raid. I don't think anybody knows one way or the other, really, but certainly we stopped a bolt hole for a very big ship like that. The other thing was that we demonstrated that it was possible with good planning and a skilled force of Navy and Army to get ashore in France in a very difficult place, up an estuary, land soldiers, beat up the Germans, blow things up, and anyhow get some people away. So that I think it gave a boost to the feeling that a lot was possible, and it certainly gave in France, because I know this, I know a lot of French people, and it was a tremendous boost to French morale. There's four or five commandos who escaped through France found that all the well-intentioned French people, of whom they met many, knew about the raid from the wireless or radio or something, and when they said they were les évadés de Saint-Nazaire, everybody did everything for them. I think it had a remarkable effect in France. It was the first ray of light at the end of the tunnel, I think.